that the impossibility of irony in post-war Germany is echoed in the Australian nation's relationship with Aboriginal people today. Now, I'm not sure how many of you know much about Australia, but you can ask me, of course, later, things that remain obscure, because I am taking quite a bit for granted, although I'll refer to various aspects of the condition there. On the one hand, I'll outline at the beginning. On the one hand, there are lamentations about violence and social dysfunction in Aboriginal community. Hideous stories of violence and sexual abuse of children emerged in 2006. And in 2007, these scandals led to the sudden extensive assertion of the federal government's authority over Aborigines living in the Northern Territory, called the Emergency Intervention. It was a very scandalous process in many senses, but it's also caused a huge rift among the anthropologists in Australia and some very interesting battles. Old assimilationist practices were renewed, directed to reshaping personal behaviour, controlling consumption and managing local decision-making. It included forbidding the use of local languages in schools, which, of course, is an old colonial practice. The justification included assertions that Aboriginal traditions, such as indulgent child rearing and sharing of resources, were responsible for social distress. So that's on the one hand. That's part of the public discourse. On the other hand, there is a reverence for Aboriginal culture. State-funded programs are directed towards reviving something called Aboriginal culture, which I'm putting capitals to. The celebration of Aboriginal culture or Aboriginality is evident in federal and state parliaments, in universities, colleges and museums, in legislation and policy documents. Elaborate respect is paid to an abstract indigeneity, which individual Aboriginal people are called upon to represent. Culture is thus part of government projects that have specific, systematic, and yet paradoxical effects on the self-imaginings and political action available to Indigenous people in varied circumstances. My paper aims to contribute to the study of postmodern cultures that are not inherited, but are consciously created, manufactured, or fabricated. And the term, of course, depends on the political meaning being embraced. I'm considering how these new forms of identity relate to governing national ideology and practice on the one hand, and to Aboriginal identities and Aboriginal politics on the other. I'll now introduce examples of ethnographic observations from two sites that generated this analysis. And as Holly said, I've worked in what are known as remote, rural and urban Aboriginal groups. And these terms are very important in the public discourses about Aborigines. I'm going to use the PowerPoint to sort of give you little excerpts from the paper so as hopefully to help you follow more closely. The first vignette is an event in 2009 at the funeral of a senior Aboriginal man at Bulman in south central Arnhem Land, 200 miles from the nearest town. So this is a remote place. It's typical of a remote Aboriginal community, about 150 permanent Aboriginal residents with smaller satellite outstations and a dozen or so white service providers. The funeral crowd consisted mostly of local and visiting relatives of the deceased. Some local Christians and a motley group of whites, teachers and other workers in the community, government department representatives, the Northern Land Council representatives and members of a local pastoralist family. Some features of the funeral funerals have changed in the time I've been working there. I started working in this community in 1975. Usually these are very long ceremonies, weeks leading up to maybe a week of rather intensive ritual, and then the final 2 days of people performing ceremonial actions all night and so on before the body is buried. In this case, the main business was compressed into 1 day, and that was partly because the son of the deceased had to be taken back to jail that night, and the jail's 600 kilometres north. So, but it was a traditional ceremony with yurta men who were Gijan, if any of you know the language of the traditional moieties in this area. Dua men as Jungai were dancing through the night, and the Gijan were watching and directing the process. And in the morning, the coffin arrived and was placed in a prepared bark shelter. Women and children were dancing. The whole crowd was painted up with white ochre. And the local Christian group sang hymns in Rimbaranga and in English. But the core of the point I want to make is here. A disturbing and embarrassing event epitomised the theme of this essay. The widow was mourning in the standard Aboriginal way, loudly expressing her grief, and two white fellas, a married couple who were recent and I thought presumptuous acquaintances of the deceased, insistently attempted to mute her crying, to hug her and shush her, and as would be common in a Western at a Western funeral, to reassure her of their abiding love. The display climaxed when the casket was being buried. As the widow threatened ever more vehemently to throw herself into the hole with her husband's body, the couple physically held on to her, telling her that her family needed her, while her family stood around in what I thought was acute but passive discomfort. These visitors, a retired local government official from Catherine and his wife, had befriended the widow during the previous months while her husband had been in an aged care facility in the local town, 200 kilometres away. They were clearly unaware that mourners at a Rimbaranga funeral are obliged to express grief in explicit ways, and that interfering with the performance by trying to console and soothe her was quite inappropriate and contrary to funeral behaviour. And the further interesting point was that the widow's daughter later replayed the scene for me as a farce, and she said, "Mum had that bloke going." And I thought here she was capturing her awareness of the incongruity of this situation. I don't think she was criticising or commenting on the actual emotions or sincerity of any of the parties. But the cultural incongruity is a familiar condition for Bulman people, and a delight in the ridiculous is a common feature of sociality that serves them well. Laughter is regularly wrung from the vagaries of everyday life, even in otherwise painful circumstances. These visitors' ignorance of funeral protocols among people they profess friendship and sympathy with is more than just an individual failing to be corrected, perhaps with a cultural awareness course, which are a common practice too in Australia today. Rather, it exemplifies a widespread theme in Australian national discourses, a sentimental love of Aboriginality which, while disputed and contradicted, narcissistic and fickle, is also ubiquitous. What happened a bit later was another feature, a new feature, a bridge between the collective worlds represented at the funeral of a man who had been a public figure of some significance. An open mic was offered to anyone who wished to speak to the gathering. About a dozen people took turns to offer memories and tributes to the deceased. Significant here is that several of the visitors who spoke exhorted the Bulman people to keep their culture, for which they expressed heartfelt admiration. One said, "What you people have is family, something many lonely people in the city would envy. You need to keep to the right path, keep your culture, look after family." Another, who had herself been a stolen generation child, which is a very well-known characteristic of Australian history, said that some of us lost our culture, but you still know who you are. You must keep it going, your culture. These explicit conceptualisations and exhortations about Aboriginal culture are now familiar elements within concerned public discourse. They represent a post-1970s articulation of the relationship between Rimbaranga people and outsiders, in which the conceptual category Aboriginal culture is positioned as a master signifier within governmental public discourses, and I'll return to that notion a little later. The urging to keep your culture is not a new and isolated event and not confined to Australian Aborigines. But what is odd here is the fact that governments are instigating cultural revival, even in remote places where Aborigines are usually seen as having their culture, having traditional culture. The new, that is, it's something that you either have or you don't have. The new position of cultural support officer, for instance, is now established at the Bulman School and gives a Rembrandt man a salary to teach the culture to Rembrandt children. And the intention is to improve attendance and achieve other behavioural changes. These are examples of objectifying and mythologising of culture. This process is much more evident in urban institutions, to which we will now turn. I'll move now to the western suburbs of Sydney, which is an absolutely different environment entirely. Here, Aboriginal families are scattered among others, many in public housing in a vast suburban sprawl. These are known as mixed-race people, with no language, no ceremonial life, and no kinship structures to distinguish them from their neighbours. At a primary school in Western Sydney, there is a Koori room. Koori is the New South Wales term, or Eastern New South Wales term, for Aboriginal person. This Koori room is festooned with iconic cultural symbols such as boomerangs and spears, and dominated by children's paintings of animals and birds decorated with dots and lines. You all have heard of dot painting, presumably, in the major, most famed form of traditional Aboriginal art that is now hugely valuable internationally. During Koori hour each day from 2 to 3 p.m., a group of Aboriginal children here learn their culture. A local elder teaches Aboriginal painting once a week about traditional foods, medicines and artefacts. Children attend on the basis of Aboriginal ancestry, but also because of a perceived need for alternative forms of schooling for children that tend to truant and behave badly. So there's a sort of interesting confusion between those reasons for them being there, but it's never quite spelled out. This program was established in the context of public awareness of the scandalously low levels of Indigenous educational achievement. On this day, Koori hour begins with an Anglo teacher whose name is Miss Habib, which says something about her marital history, not about her her family history. She tells the children, "We're going to make totems today." I'm hoping these things are in the right order. Yes. "Your totem is a special animal or bird. What would you like your totem to be?" The children have to be prompted to choose a snake or a kookaburra, a kangaroo or a lizard. Miss Habib then gives each child a cardboard tube, the inside of a toilet roll, very common artifact in primary schools. And they use paints and crayons to draw their totem on this cardboard tube. They help themselves to string and wool to wind around, and feathers, ribbons and glitter to stick on as further decoration. Sitting at the back of the classroom, I channel the ancestors, both Aboriginal and anthropological, and they feel appalled. The sacred totem is being treated with shocking irreverence, and in the name of recognising and reviving what is said to be Aboriginal culture, the Aboriginal culture of these suburban children. There is no hint that the totem refers to powerful forces within a coherent cosmology. As documented by a number of anthropologists who worked with senior Aboriginal authorities. Totems once, and still do in some places, encapsulate complex beliefs that were part of organic knowledge and effective meanings that energised whole societies. The notion that an individual can choose their own totem for the day seems particularly bizarre, because traditional totems were emplaced, stable and owned. However, it's clear that Ms. Habib's evocation of the totem bears little relationship to any social reality outside the classroom, and the imaginative world she and the children are constructing is free of ancestral power. But a narrow interpretation that deplores the use of Aboriginal culture as a diversion or therapy for difficult school pupils would deny the actual work that teacher and pupils are engaged in within this classroom. These unruly, inattentive children do become intent on fabricating their personal totem from the decorative bling offered to them. Watching them, I realised that both children and teacher are vesting something of themselves in these small created objects that they are calling totems. The significance of this new kind of totem should not be foreclosed because it may offend someone who is not even present. When it what appears to be occurring here is a radical shift of totems away from species group identification, localism, ownership, and the taboos associated with it, towards a postmodern conception where it's possible to ask, as I heard someone do recently, is that a self-chosen totem, or did she get it through kinship? Thus, there are now two valid alternate ways of acquiring a totem, a dreaming, a clan, dances, song and design, all these sort of typical things that Aboriginal people do in suburban areas that they gain knowledge of often from the internet. A collective world is being made that incorporates Aboriginality within the schools and other institutions, framed by a multicultural ideology that is hospitable and welcoming towards others' cultural symbols and practices. Aboriginal children are being helped to construct a valid place within the suburban place where they dwell. Totems are signs that a new social identity is being constructed at the margins of Australian society, out of discarded shards of cultural symbols that memory or the internet can dredge up. There were other examples of what seemed like irreverence towards previously sanctioned knowledge. For instance, C.S. Lewis's novel, children's novel, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, was used as a stand-in for the story of the ancestral creative spirit of Southeast Australia, whose name was Biami. Miss Hebby read a little from the story of Narnia, where the lion appears and begins to create the world. She asked the class, "The lion began to create the world in this story. Who began Australia in the dream time?" One child responds, "Captain Cook, Miss." Another, "The kangaroo." I mean, these are children who are, you know, generally rather backward, or certainly inattentive. It's hard to get their attention at all, so they respond the first thing that comes into the head. The right answer, eventually supplied by Miss Habib, is the rainbow serpent, who was directed by the ancestral creative being Biami. The association of Captain Cook with beginnings in Australia is ubiquitous, so the children are not reprimanded for foolishness in suggesting that these things were created for Aboriginal ancestors. It is clear that any response from these children is valued, for they are paying attention and perhaps absorbing something valuable. Questions of schooling and discipline are clearly relevant here. In fact, the curiao is becoming more popular over time, and so the Aboriginal children are now bringing a non-Aboriginal friend to curiao, and it's a reward for good behaviour in other classes. So it's an interesting reversal, and it may say something about the great success. Curiao, then, is a part of a pedagogy that socialises children into a world where social identity is something to be chosen, manufactured in the present, performed or presented in public, and supported by all kinds of consumer items that signal belonging. My observation of Curiao over some months aimed to understand how Aboriginality was being imagined and deployed. Initially, my suspicions echoed Noel Pearson's observation. Noel Pearson's a well-known Aboriginal activist and intellectual in Australia, perhaps one of the best known, one of the most able, and very politically, in a certain sense, conservative, seen as very conservative. He said, "It is somewhat morally disturbing that a program to preserve culture is implemented in a white-oriented institution that represents the very same ideas that have contributed to cultural disintegration in the first place." But, as I've hinted already, there's quite another way of viewing this process, especially in these suburban conditions. In a world where there are competing schemas for recognising authenticity and cultural presence, these children are being enabled to fashion an identity for themselves. The teacher is mediating between a traditional culture where identity is ascribed, transmitted on the basis of ancestry, and a freely chosen identity that makes sense in contemporary society. The children can adapt, adopt, and experiment with this identity. Aboriginality is being added to the mix of fabricated identities that abound in popular culture. And as elements of culture from immigrant populations have been adopted in Australia, and Australia now welcomes items that signify generic Aboriginal culture. Thus, while preservation of culture is part of a wider system of governance that appears hospitable to other social forms so long as they do not threaten its own, the recognition of their culture is, as I've said, creating a space within which school children can reimagine themselves and reorient Aboriginality. Thus, cultural revival has two independent generative sources, the hegemonic nation and the subordinated and valorised Indigenous population. The meaning of the term culture is shifting away from established social relations and increasingly refers to more malleable and individualistic emblems of identity and emerging cultural self-consciousness. The multicultural student is another role recognised in Western Sydney schools. At an annual Harmony Day, children wear national costumes, bring national food or artefacts, and perform national dances and songs. National here is equivalent to cultural in the Indigenous arena. In this area, many of the schools have a great number of migrant children. Aboriginal culture is part of Harmony Day, and in this case, in the form of a dance group, one of several formed some years ago to display Aboriginal culture at various venues. Terry's troupe is made up of high school students that he is teaching to dance, whose families have identified as Aboriginal. The process of identification as Aboriginal is another important process that's recognised in Australia. Some Aboriginal families may have the stolen children are the classic ones, but other people have been separated from their families, have intermarried with whites. They may be fair-skinned. They may not have identified as Aboriginal in an earlier generation. Today, and certainly since this cultural revival process has become so prevalent, many Aboriginal people have identified and have come out and joined organisations, have taken part in public assertion of Aboriginality. And so Terry is one of these, I think. Now, I'm not going to read all this because it's quite long. He's made up, as I said, they're high school students. His style is evangelical, with rhythmic speech persuasively and successfully urging engaged responses from the children. Now, I include the longest quotation because there's many ideas there, for instance, about a true Aboriginality and part Aboriginality, about spirituality, about losing your culture. So I won't read it all. Did you get through the first bit? Okay. So he's speaking to the children. Are you a real Aboriginal? I say, come up and touch me, feel me, see if I'm real or not. Then they might say, but Terry, and he's got a very persuasive style. She's Irish, do you style it? Too many witchetty grubs. Witchetty grubs, of course, is a sort of stigmatised practice. Aboriginals eat witchetty grubs, yuck. So he's... And another element there is the sort of moralising. You know, good food. The traditional food is good food. Is that the last one? Yeah. This group is recreating its members' sense of themselves, positioning themselves within practices and discourses that are acceptable and easily related to in this area. Terry's family explicitly works at finding and performing culture through dancing, storytelling and painting. They see this work as both a way of earning a living. They don't earn very much, but it is an income for people living otherwise on Social Security. It's an important income. And a prevention against the troubles and pitfalls that beset other branches of their family in a world where drugs and drink and other supposedly degenerative practices are common. And his father said, this is his father, the whole family is engaged in these dance troupes and painting and so on, in this cultural revival process. In reviving rituals, dances and stories, explicitly to save themselves and their people, this family is claiming for themselves the idea that state institutions promote, that is, culture conceived as a practical solution to Aborigine social problems. This cultural revival owes little to local ancestry. Elements are taken from memory, as I said, from the internet and from all over the place. This is work, both in the sense of labouring towards a specific goal of betterment and in the sense of making a living. And the relationship between work and culture is important here. Where people view rituals and stories as forms of work, it says something about how the realm of symbols and the real are related. These cultural symbols sometimes appear bogus and a kind of decoration on social life, but they can also be active elements mobilised through willful expenditure of energy to construct a meaningful social world. So Terry, as well as other dance groups, are engaged in manufacturing markers of identity that the nation now recognises as legitimate. So they're playing into this acceptance of a certain form of Aboriginality. At the same time, state institutions are vigorously putting work into their stories and rituals that are directed at repositioning Australian Aborigines within the nation. So certain features of this national process of repositioning Aborigines are the inversion of the older Australian history so that Aborigines are now included as victims of Australian history. The adoption of ritual welcomes, for instance, and acknowledgements of country at many public events around the universities as well as elsewhere. An Aboriginal person is often invited to welcome the guests to country, even if it's not their country. They're acknowledging the traditional owners. And these elaborate rituals are usually made in the face of the absence of any other Aboriginal people, which is never mentioned. The commissioning of Indigenous motifs for display in public places, very, very common practice, and the repositioning of Australian intellectuals in relation to autochthony. A body of powerful narcissistic white fellas expressing a morally weighty desire for symbols and signs of indigeneity have emerged, but they often find actual black fellas rather distasteful. For instance, the love love for and purchase of Aboriginal art, while intended to support and celebrate our Indigenous people, seldom allows for human intimacy, especially if the artists are sitting on the earth in remote places or living in Wilcannia. And I refer to a work by Lorraine Gibson on art in a country town. Thus, the recognition process and cultural revival are secreted battlegrounds for authority and supremacy. The events I've described in Western, in a suburban school and in remote traditional community provide examples of what von Sturmer has depicted as an implacable hegemonic necrophilia, where the nation gains pleasure from the cultural body it has killed and deems itself virtuous. But savagery is only part of this story, because, as I've argued, Aborigines are grasping the opportunity to manufacture forms of culture that are matters of choice rather than ancestry. And nor should we dismiss ourselves, I think, as mere necrophiliacs. I now want to build on this material and discuss first the master signifier notion and then the absurd, the notion of the significance of the absurd. So Aboriginal culture as a master signifier. In semiotic terms, I'm suggesting that Aboriginal culture has become a master signifier beneath which totems, dreaming stories, clans, Aboriginal dancing and painting now gain meaning for the Australian nation. What were once conceptual symbols within another order of meaning are now meaningful as subordinate to the signifier Aboriginal culture. This master signifier is at work structuring an array of terms, images and ideas, helping to form a stable symbolic order within Australia's national ideological apparatus to refer to and encompass Aboriginal people and their attributes. The master concept, by casting its light over others, increasingly empties itself of any determinate meaning. That's Zizek's view. Rather than retaining meaning within a traditional realm that precedes and is independent of the nation, that is the realm of the old man that was being buried at Bulman, the totems, dances and designs, etc., are increasingly understood to be referring to the nation's Aboriginal culture. Here the master signifier is necessarily arbitrary. It bears no necessary relationship to any specific reality, but more important here, it is always haunted by the return of the real. And in my usage, the real is the embodied, living, symbolic order that escapes the order of the master signifier. The real is evident in remote places as well as in the intentional constructions I've been describing. That is, there are many storytellers and painters like Terry in urban Australia, where the majority and fastest growing Aboriginal population lives. While indebted to the master signifier, they are also haunting it by reinserting life into these signs, disturbing their passive position as sign and reworking them as living symbols that register and proclaim the significance of their own particular embodied histories and lives. I'm further suggesting that cultural revivalism has two interdependent arms, that of the agents of the state and that of Aboriginal people. I think I said that before, but at times they are complementary, working together to make some form of Aboriginality more visible and legitimate. This common purpose is apparent where state-sponsored support for cultural revival allows Aboriginal people's authority over their own social identity to edge back into significance after two centuries of erosion. So, I mean, this is really the sort of background that Aboriginal people were erased from significance in the nation up till 1970 at least, and after that, since then, there's been a gradual turnaround so that now Aboriginality is highly valorised. However, the complementarity between the state and these Aboriginal people is always in danger of becoming conflict, as living Aboriginality presents challenges to the autonomy and emptiness of the master signifier. And there's an example comes from the work by Everett, where she describes a play put on in Western Sydney, and a group of people that she has studied who have quite deliberately created their own rituals and language, were asked to play the part of their ancestors as the victims of Australian colonial forces. So on the stage show, they were shot, so the Aboriginal people had to fall down. But instead of falling down and remaining silent until the curtain fell, they started writhing and groaning and wouldn't get off the stage for the next stage of the play, and they embarrassed everybody terribly. I thought this was a wonderful example of, you know, the haunting I'm talking about. These are real people who want to say something, and they were making themselves really troublesome. Now I want to talk about absurdism, which is one of my favourite concepts in this context. It's time to make clear the significance of the absurd in my argument. Fundamental is the idea developed initially by philosopher Kierkegaard that the human search for some meaning, some given meaning, in a godless, unintelligible world is futile. I want to use the recognition that meaning is man-made and thus essentially social to bear on the way the concept of culture is being deployed. And I won't talk about the development of absurdist theatre. But what absurdist theatre showed was that while the temporality of social life, the enduring institutions, the material and everyday forms of sociality assert and shore up shared meanings, a fundamental arbitrariness and the menace of meaninglessness can be glimpsed at the margins, always hinting at the fragility of the social world. Because meaning is only ever contingent and can thus collapse, we're all vulnerable to insanity. The depressed and the mentally ill testify that the meaning of social relations can be lost. The truly radical refuse, sometimes involuntarily, the logic and sense offered by the world and are deemed mad. While it is commonplace that elements of social practice, abandoned rituals, old-fashioned manners and so on cease to make sense, I'm suggesting also that a whole symbolic system, along with the coherent social relations it underpinned, can lose its hold and cease to bind its people. What we call traditional societies everywhere have some experience of this. Cultural revival may appear to create meaninglessness, appearing to mock the transcendental authority of traditional symbols like the totem. But I would argue that revivalism more fundamentally reveals the arbitrariness of social worlds and their symbolic orders. The nation and its anthropologists, though, continue to refer to the culture of Aborigines as a coherent, if disturbed, moral order. And this notion of culture, anthropologists are constantly saying, you know, Aboriginal culture is under threat, it's changing, it's disturbed. But nonetheless, that core concept is still there very deeply in our thinking. I'll come to that in a minute. This notion of culture remains the core mode of understanding the current condition of Indigenous life in Australia. By focusing on particular incongruities in this essay, I'm attempting to gain some critical distance from this pervasive understanding and from bland concepts like cross-cultural and intercultural that people are struggling with to revive and keep their core concept. I'm suggesting that the overinflated bubble of the culture concept, still the anthropological keyword par excellence, is collapsing to the dismay of its anthropological investors. As cultural revivalism appropriates and reformulates the notion of Aboriginal culture, the conceptual habits that reify culture are becoming anthropologically embarrassing. Clinging to the culture concept makes anthropological analysis increasingly irrelevant, not just to current public debates about the intervention, but to Indigenous political thought. From within the cultural tradition where totemism originated, or from within the anthropological tradition where totemism became an analytic object, choosing your totem, etc., is absurd in the usual sense of incongruous and nonsensical. But it is also absurd in the tragic philosophical sense because it illustrates the arbitrariness of symbolic meanings and adds to the increasing incoherence of classical Aboriginal culture as a modern regime takes hold in Aboriginal communities. I think I might have a sip of water. So perhaps it was the presence of the anthropologist in the classroom with her baggage of classical anthropology that rendered the totem making absurd. And further, the difficulty of sifting the progressive from the regressive added to my discomfort and provoked an intimation of the absurd. But rather than deciding whether we should be sad or glad that totems are losing their connection with the social reality generated outside modern Western society, we should be trying to understand the work that cultural revivalism is doing. At a more experiential level, I'm suggesting cultural revivalism can contribute to the freeing up of traditional regimes of value, offering newly conceived forms of identity to those who've been repeatedly displaced from their former habitus, that is, to Aboriginal people in general. It is easy to read the classroom scene as trite, and there's many other examples, the dancing that occurs in many public places. I have an anthropological friend who cringes at the very thought of these reproductions in urban conditions of traditional dancing in a form that is, you know, to her quite trite and foolish. But I'm suggesting, as I've said, these things have value. The teacher's professed love of things indigenous could also be seen as phony. The goodwill and conviction of the school could be seen as assuming unwarranted authority over contemporary Aboriginality. But such interpretations deny the positive productive possibilities that emerge as ancestral authority dissolves. And they deny the school's idealistic dreams and desire for justice, the transcendent intention that aim beyond the mundane remedies for local, material and social conditions, which is often the focus of discourse. You know, the statistical evidence of Aboriginal poor health, high levels of incarceration in prison, high levels of alcoholism, low levels of education and so on. These things are constantly talked about. But I'm saying that these appeals to a sort of more transcendental form of being has some value. Of course, cultural revival can also produce conflict and confusion among Aboriginal people, including a fear that they will be made to look ridiculous if culture is just made up. But the discourse about cultural revival is heavily imbued with moral pleasure, because the ideology of improvement is seductive. More culture is said to create cohesion, improve relationships, enhance self-esteem. Finally, as the Bulman funeral illustrated, veneration for culture can be a stand-in for engagement with those who supposedly embody the culture and who are both the object of and the barrier to improvement. Lauren Berlant spoke of the political confusion where forms of progress also and at the same time support destructive practices of social antagonism. However, so she's saying, you know, how do you decide what is a progressive process? The further problem, though, is that forms of analysis that appear progressive or liberal, such as support for cultural revival, may conceal an essential, insurmountable ambiguity of consequences. So I'm saying that this cultural revival has extremely ambiguous outcomes and meanings, even recognising the value that I've described. Because the situation in Western Sydney would appear to be in stark contrast with those in the remote community where I started describing that funeral, where people are said to have culture, more should be said about cultural revivalism in what are spoken of as remote or traditionally oriented communities. But I only have time to hint at how remote conditions are open to an absurdist interpretation. I think I've probably said enough about that. We could discuss that. I'll just read my final paragraph. Or two. Is it two paragraphs? Attempts to install shared meanings of Aboriginal culture in the nation's imagination threaten to reveal absurdity within the nation's social order. A portentous moralism conceals the ideological incoherence of public discourse concerning Indigenous policy, rendering Aboriginal conditions as a crisis and the people as exceptional, allowed the government to implement an aggressive experimentation in welfare policy reform, that is, the emergency intervention mentioned at the start. The anxiety about dysfunction based on statistical evidence coexists with a language of love for indigeneity that suffuses public discourses. If cultural revivalism is taken literally, nonsense emerges. A people is being taught their own culture. I mean, from an anthropological point of view, this is nonsense. Often by people who don't even claim to have it, within a framework of therapeutic remedialism administered by authorities from another cultural realm. Further, the wholly admirable intention of cultural recognition is prefaced on the non-recognition in practice of Aboriginal authority over the symbols of culture. So even in Western Sydney schools, you might have an elder there, but he's in no sense a representative of any social group. He's picked out by the school or offered or through all sorts of accidents. It is because acts of cultural recognition and revival appeal to a series of overlapping but contradictory meanings that they cannot logically negate one another. So suddenly they can turn into their opposites, for instance, into attacks on culture as cause rather than solution. A number of anthropologists have supported the idea that Aboriginal culture is a barrier to Aboriginal advancement. The inversion of this truism says that mainstream culture is a barrier to the expression of Aboriginal culture. Such reasoning trivialises the dilemmas and difficulties of actual people and their social lives and obscures the power relations that are at work evaluating and managing others' racialised cultural realms. With cultural dysfunction accepted as a public truth and suffering as the accepted trope to describe Aboriginal community life, Australia has returned to the old view of Aboriginality as a deficit way of being and Aboriginal culture as responsible for Aboriginal ills. Thus, the eagerness to emplace an imagined Aboriginal culture within the institutions of the state appears to contradict one platform of the bipartisan intervention policy. The resolution of this surface contradiction is clear. The nation's newfound affection for Indigenous culture and its symbols refers not to a way of life or a system of social relations, let alone to any particular Aboriginal people, but to a fantasised way of being signified as Aboriginal culture. I'll leave it there.
Thank you. I love that paper, and I love the fact that I introduced that paper by embarrassing you. And as you were talking, I felt waves of different forms of embarrassment about, like, a sympathetic embarrassment for you sitting in the classroom, channeling your ancestors, the anthropological ancestors, and your informants from Bulman, and this feeling of disjuncture. And I wonder if you could speak more about embarrassment as it runs through Australian race relations, and of course that links to things like cultural cringe as sort of an adopted cultural pose, but also how does embarrassment work in Bulman and that sort of thing. I was also thinking about whether your analysis of the standing of classic Aboriginal culture and how that works for contemporary urban, suburban Aboriginal people, actual real people, whether their experience parallels our experience of carrying on anthropology in a post-classical period, in that in Australian anthropology, we have the weight of these ancestors who gave us a legacy of a lot of ethnography that now seems...